From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
So I feel like what I'm witnessing here is a very systematic destruction of people's ability to survive. And that is incredibly horrifying.
American peace activist Rachel Corrie. She was crushed to death by an Israeli military bulldozer 3 years ago today. People around the world are remembering Rachel's life by staging readings of her words. Then we go to Florida, where nearly 200 janitors are on strike at the University of Miami, run by Donna Shalala, the former Secretary of Health and Human Services under Clinton. We'll have a debate, but first, crackdown. The U.S. government is blocking a prominent Bolivian scholar from entering the country, while a Venezuelan-born professor in California has also come under the watch of federal agents. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The Bush administration plans to release its quadrennial national security strategy later today. The document reiterates the White House's commitment to launching preemptive strikes against countries it decides are a threat to national security and interests. The security strategy places new emphasis on Iran, stating, quote, "We may face no greater challenge from a single country than Iran. The Iranian regime sponsors terrorism, threatens Israel, seeks to thwart Middle East peace, disrupts democracy in Iraq," he said. Meanwhile, UN Ambassador John Bolton has likened the potential threat of Iran's nuclear program to the 9/11 attacks. In an interview with ABC News, Bolton said, quote, "Just like September 11th, only with nuclear weapons this time, that's the threat. I think it's just facing reality. It's not a happy reality, but it's reality. And if you don't deal with it, it will become even more unpleasant." At the United Nations, the General Assembly has voted to approve a new Human Rights Council over the objection of the United States. The body's previous incarnation, the UN's Human Rights Commission, has been accused of maintaining lax standards on the human rights records of its members. The new council will be smaller in size and elected by a majority of the General Assembly. The resolution received 170 votes in its favor, with only the U.S., Israel, Marshall Islands, and Palau opposed. U.S. Ambassador John Bolton defended the Bush administration's stance.
The council that is created will be our legacy. We must not let the victims of human rights abuses throughout the world think that UN member states were willing to settle for good enough. We must not let history remember us as the architects of a council that was a compromise and merely the best we could do, rather than one that ensured doing all we could do to promote human rights.
That was UN Ambassador John Bolton. In Iraq, the trial of Saddam Hussein continued Wednesday with a fiery, lengthy speech from the deposed Iraqi president. At one point, Saddam Hussein condemned the recent bombing of a Shia shrine and sparred with the presiding judge.
"What I heard about our nation recently is a darkness that has never befallen our nation before. It was a strange matter worthy of condemnation, and my mind and soul say to me that the great and faithful Iraqi nation is innocent of the blowing up of the Imam Ali shrine."
"You are accused of a very serious crime in which innocent people died. Answer to this matter. This is a court of law. What has politics got to do with this?"
"I will address the Iraqis who are concerned with this matter. It has nothing to do with you."
Saddam Hussein went on to urge Iraqis to stop civil violence and focus armed attacks on foreign troops. After over 40 minutes of the defiant speech, the judge ordered all journalists out of the court. Meanwhile, a U.S. military attack in the Iraqi town of Balad is being blamed for the deaths of at least a dozen members of the same family. The dead include 5 children and 6 women. The Associated Press is reporting the family's house was flattened by an airstrike from a U.S. helicopter. The victims were wrapped in blankets and driven to the Tikrit General Hospital. Ahmed Khalaf, the brother of one of the victims, said, quote, "The dead family was not part of the resistance. They were women and children. The Americans have promised us a better life, but we get only death." In other news, the top U.S. military commander in Iraq has indicated the U.S. may want to hold on to the several military bases it's built in the country. Appearing before a congressional subcommittee Tuesday, General John Abizaid said the U.S. may want to keep a foothold in Iraq to support regional moderates and protect oil supplies. The two top leaders of Israel and the Palestinians traded barbs Wednesday in the aftermath of Israel's raid on a Jericho prison. Israeli troops stormed the prison Tuesday after British monitors were moved from guarding five Palestinians accused of murdering a former Israeli cabinet member. This is Interim Prime Minister Ehud Olmert.
Once the inspectors were pulled out, against the background of the international agreement signed, for which we were a partner, and the Palestinian Authority was a partner, it became inevitable, but that we will try and bring to justice the six suspects who were arrested in Jericho.
In Jericho, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas toured the prison and called the raid an unforgivable crime.
What happened, without a doubt, is an ugly crime which cannot be forgiven, and a humiliation for the Palestinian people, and a clear violation of all the agreements which took place between us and them. From here, we don't only condemn, but we consider this more an ugly crime which has led to what it led to. Now, kidnapping Saadat and Shoubaki and their brothers is illegal.
That was Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas in Jericho. In Ecuador, protests against a proposed trade agreement with the United States continue to sweep the country. The demonstrations have grown to tens of thousands as indigenous communities have marched from the Andes Mountains to join them. Protesters are calling on the Ecuadorian government to reject a so-called free trade agreement with the United States. On Wednesday, Ecuador's interior minister resigned in the face of massive protests. Just last week, over 4,000 oil workers went on strike demanding 3 months back pay from Ecuador's state-owned oil company. In Serbia, the body of the former leader Slobodan Milosevic returned home Wednesday. Milosevic will be buried Saturday in his hometown southeast of the capital of Belgrade. Here in the United States, civil rights advocates are criticizing the Bush administration over a recent change to rules allowing gay men and lesbians access to national security clearances. Last year, the Bush administration quietly removed language that says sexual orientation, quote, may not be used as a basis for or a disqualifying factor in determining a person's eligibility for a security clearance. And today marks the third anniversary of the death of Rachel Corrie. The U.S. peace activist was crushed to death by an Israeli bulldozer as she was attempting to stop the demolition of a Palestinian home in the Gaza town of Raqqa. She was 23 years old. People around the world today are remembering her life by staging readings of her writings. We'll hear her words in just a few minutes. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
And welcome to all of our listeners and viewers. An Israeli soldier was killed in a fierce gun battle in the West Bank city of Jenin Thursday during a raid by Israeli forces. The raid came hours after gunmen shot and wounded two Israeli motorists near a Jewish settlement. The spike in violence followed Tuesday's assault on a prison in Jericho by Israeli forces. In the raid, Israeli troops seized five Palestinians accused of assassinating former Israeli tourism minister Rehavam Ze'evi. Israel used helicopters and tanks to fire at the prison before smashing through its walls with armed bulldozers. Two Palestinians were killed during the assault, and a third has since died of his injuries. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas angrily denounced the raid on Wednesday. Speaking at the destroyed jail, Abbas called the attack, quote, an ugly crime which cannot be forgiven and a humiliation for the Palestinian people. Abbas also said the raid has only been carried out to boost the Israeli government's chances in the coming elections.
Meanwhile, Palestinians across Gaza and the West Bank have gone on strike over Israel's seizure of militant Ahmed Sadat, the leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, as well as four others. Acting Prime Minister Ehud Olmert defended the move, saying, quote, "We're proud we have imposed justice on these killers without hurting unfairly any other person who was not involved." The five had been in the prison under guard from British and U.S. jailers. But early Tuesday, the British government removed the supervisors, citing security reasons. The Israeli government said it raided the prison to prevent a Hamas government from carrying out a promise to release the prisoners. Many Palestinians are accusing the British and U.S. governments of colluding with Israel in the raid. President Abbas also questioned how Israeli forces had known so precisely when to start their attack, just minutes after the international monitors were withdrawn. The British government has denied any collusion. Following the raid, armed Palestinians kidnapped at least 11 foreigners in the West Bank and Gaza. All of the hostages have since been released. For more on the latest, we're joined on the telephone right now by Nasir Arouri, professor emeritus of political science at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. He's author of the book Dishonest Broker, America's Role in Israel and Palestine. His forthcoming book is Palestine and the Palestinians. Professor Arouri, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy.
Your response to what has taken place over the last few days in Jericho?
Well, I think that here we see that a series of mistakes and illegalities have been committed. I mean, to begin with, Ahmed Sadat, the new head of the Palestine, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, he and his colleagues were actually sentenced illegally 4 years ago by a military court headed by Arafat, somebody from the Arafat dynasty who has no training in the law whatsoever. Then they were held illegally by virtue of a political arrangement, an extra-legal arrangement, as Amnesty calls it, by the British, the U.S., as well as the PA and Israel. And now they are kidnapped and incarcerated in Israel proper illegally, since the occupying power does not really have the right to remove people under its occupation to its own territory and put them on trial. And this is a violation of international law. I mean, these people are actually virtually political prisoners. There's not much that is being discussed about the legality of it. The fact that this could have been an election stunt, I think, is almost self-explanatory. I mean, Olmert has succeeded Sharon, and he's demonstrating a muscular policy, even though the Jericho prison is not Iran, but I guess it is his way telling the Likud party that he is capable of decisive action, and here we did it, we got them, as headlines appeared in the Israeli press.
And Professor Arouri, your sense of the impact across the rest of the Arab world, not only of the raid, but then of these images, photographs of other Palestinian prisoners being stripped to their underwear that was in many of the press around the world?
Well, it's a very humiliating thing for the Arab world, even though the Arab world has been really reticent about the events that have taken place over the past few years. I mean, Israel is treating the Palestine Authority and Arabs as irrelevant, with contempt. Everything is unilateral. The agreements are unilateral. Former agreements that have been signed since Oslo are being sidelined. The Arab press actually yesterday was filled with editorials and commentaries about the prison storming, and emphasizing the fact that Israel has no regard whatsoever for agreements since Oslo, that this is a blow to Abbas, and that when it comes to international law, there is absolute irrelevance, and Israel treats international law with contempt and irrelevance. So there is really a storm across the Arab world. As to whether this will dissipate or whether it will have an impact, I think it remains to be seen.
We're talking to Nasser Arouri, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth, author of Dishonest Broker, America's Role in Israel and Palestine. Sadat was sent to Jericho in 2002 under an internationally brokered deal that ended the Israeli siege that year of the late Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat's compound at Ramallah. Can you talk about that and what this means in relation to that international agreement?
Well, actually, Ehud Olmert, I think, used international agreement. I think it's hardly an international agreement. The story begins, actually, with the assassination of Abu Ali Mustafa, which somehow nobody seems to talk about. Abu Ali Mustafa was the top leader of the PFLP. He was sitting in his office in Ramallah, and suddenly he was hit by a missile that was fired from a helicopter, and he was shredded to pieces. Naturally, the PFLP retaliated by assassinating a minister of tourism in Israel, Rehavim Zaevi, who was an advocate of ethnic cleansing of the Palestinians. He made no point to hide it, and he was known to be an advocate of ethnic cleansing. So now the Israelis would be holding Sadat as responsible since he became the new head of the PFLP. And Sadat took refuge in Arafat's office in Ramallah. The Israelis come and they besiege Arafat's office, and that so-called international agreement is forged, whereby Arafat would save his skin by basically sacrificing Sadat and his colleagues and acquiescing in an agreement that was brokered by the U.S. and the U.K., and Israel and the PA. So you have four partners here, four parties to it, whereby Sadat and his colleagues were sent to Jericho under the jurisdiction of the Palestine Authority, but under the supervision of Britain and the U.S. So you have U.S. and British monitors guarding the prison. And as we heard, these people decide to leave on Tuesday morning, and minutes after that, Israel storms the compound. This is really an illegal agreement. I mean, it's not an international agreement. It's an agreement that was imposed on the weak PA. They had no choice, and as I said, Arafat was trying to basically save his own skin, and he succeeded in doing that by having acquiesced, really, in an arrangement that's an extra-legal arrangement and sending them. I think I should mention here...
We just have 20 seconds.
Okay, I should mention here that the highest court of justice in the PA ordered the release of these people, and they were never released, by the way.
Nasser Arouri, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts, Dartmouth. Thank you very much for joining us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org.
Well, today is the third anniversary of the death of Rachel Corrie. On March 16, 2003, an Israeli military bulldozer crushed her to death as she was attempting to stop the demolition of the home of a Palestinian doctor in the Gaza town of Rafah. Eyewitnesses said at the time of her death, Rachel was sitting directly in the path of the bulldozer, holding a megaphone and wearing a fluorescent jacket. She was 23 years old. 3 years after her death, Rachel Corrie is at the center of a new controversy. 2 weeks ago, a New York theater company backed out of an agreement to stage the new play, My Name is Rachel Corrie, based on Rachel's writings. It premiered in London in April 2005 and was supposed to open soon at the New York Theater Workshop. But now the theater says it has been postponed indefinitely.
The play's producers are accusing the theater of censorship, but James Nicola, the artistic director of the New York Theater Workshop, has defended the decision, saying it was made following Ariel Sharon's recent stroke and the election of Hamas. Nicola said, quote, "We had a very edgy situation. We found our plan to present a work of art would be seen as us taking a stand in a political conflict that we didn't want to take." Today, to commemorate the third anniversary of Rachel's death, people around the world are remembering her life by staging readings of Rachel's words. We reached some of the organizers and asked them to describe the events.
My name is Jen Marlowe, and I'm one of the co-founders of Rachel's Words. Rachel's words started as a response to the play not opening in New York. There's been a tremendous grassroots response to this initiative. Rachel's emails and her writings are going to be read today in Iraq, in Israel, Palestine, Kosovo, Nigeria, India, England. There's going to be 70 readings, more than 70 readings so far planned, going on in cities and countries all over the world.
My name is Angela Godfrey Goldstein. I'm an Israeli peace activist. I'm action advocacy officer with the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions based in Jerusalem. Tomorrow I will be reading emails that Rachel Corrie wrote while she was alive, which I was reading at the time when she was writing them.
My name is Marcy Newman. I live in Amman, Jordan, and we are organizing a staged reading of My Name is Rachel Corrie at Booksat Cafe in Jebel Amman, neighborhood of Amman. We will be reading Rachel's writings and commemorating her death.
My name's Mike Cushman. I'm a researcher at the London School of Economics in London, UK. Tomorrow, on March 16th, the third anniversary of the killing of Rachel Corrie by an Israeli Defense Force Caterpillar bulldozer, we'll be reading from Rachel's emails home, which describe her experiences on the West Bank.
My name is Abdel Fattah Abu Sroor. I am the director of Arwad Children's Theater in Aida Camp in Bethlehem, Palestine. Tomorrow, we will be doing a reading with children of the camp about Rachel Corrie's emails. Rachel was the most beautiful face of the American country. And she was here because, as she says in her poem, I am here for other children. I am here because I care.
My name is Lynn Nelson. I'm a teacher here at Evergreen State College, where Rachel went to school. Faculty, staff, and students and community members are going to gather at a small remembered site we have here for Rachel. And we're going to be reading from the play and from other writings Rachel has done since she was a little girl.
Some of the events around the world commemorating the third anniversary of Rachel Corrie's death. We turn now to Rachel Corrie in her own words. This is an excerpt of the documentary Rachel Corrie, An American Conscience, was directed by Yahya Barakat. It includes excerpts of Rachel speaking in Gaza about the plight of the Palestinian people.
I've been here for about a month and a half now, and this is definitely the most difficult situation that I've ever seen. In the time that I've been here, children have been shot and killed. On the 30th of January, the Israeli military bulldozed the two largest water wells, destroying over half of Rafah's water supply. Every few days, if not every day, houses are demolished here. People are economically devastated because of the closure of the borders into Egypt and the extreme control of the Gazan economy by Israel. I came to look at the aftermath of a place where 25 greenhouses had been demolished on the other side of Rafah, destroying the livelihoods of about 300 people. And that had taken place while they rounded up about 150 men, held them under a sniper tower, and shot around them to contain the men, the farmers in the area. So I feel like what I'm witnessing here is a very systematic destruction of people's ability to survive. And that is incredibly horrifying. Sometimes it takes a while for it to set in what is happening here, because I think many of the people here, they try to maintain what they can of their lives. And I think, I don't know, maybe it has to do with protecting their children, that they try to be happy, joke with their children. So sometimes it takes time to it's hard to hold in your mind, you know, the complete reality of what's happening here. Sometimes I'm sitting down to dinner with people and I just realize that that there is a massive military machine surrounding them and trying to kill these people that I'm having dinner with, these families that I'm sitting down to eat with and who are being very generous and kind to me and their children here who are incredibly threatened, living lives that no child ever should have to live. And so it, I feel a lot of horror, really. I feel a lot of horror about the situation.
Rachel Corrie, from the documentary Rachel Corrie, An American Conscience, directed by Yahya Barakat. This is the third anniversary of Rachel's death. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. Back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
For the second time in 2 years, the U.S. government is blocking a prominent foreign scholar from teaching in this country due to so-called security reasons. 18 months ago, the U.S. denied a visa to Tariq Ramadan to teach at the University of Notre Dame. The Swiss-born Ramadan is considered to be one of the leading Muslim scholars in Europe. Now the U.S. government is blocking an indigenous Bolivian professor from entering the country to teach at the University of Nebraska. The professor's name is Huascar Adi. He is a member of the Aymara indigenous people in Bolivia and a leading authority on the religious beliefs and political activism in Bolivia. He received his Ph.D. at Georgetown and has spent many years studying in the United States. A State Department official told the Chronicle of Higher Education that the government has, quote, derogatory information about Ari that renders him ineligible for the visa. But the government has not shared that information with Ari or with the university. The government has not officially rejected Ari's visa, but has effectively blocked him from teaching the past two semesters.
Meanwhile, in California, a Venezuelan-born professor has also come under the watch of federal agents. Last week, Pomona College professor Miguel Tinker Salas said he was visited and questioned by two Los Angeles County Sheriff's deputies working for the FBI's Federal Anti-Terrorism Task Force. The agents questioned the Latin American Studies professor about the political situation in Venezuela and his ties to the Venezuelan government. The questioning has rattled the education community. Pomona College President David Oxtoby said he was extremely concerned about the chilling effect this could have on free scholarly and political discourse. Today we're going to speak with both professors, Professor Huascar Adi, who joins us on the phone from Bolivia, and Professor Miguel Tinker Salas, who's in a studio in Puerto Rico, where he's attending the LASA International Congress, that's Latin American Studies Association Congress in San Juan. We begin with the professor in San Juan. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much. Good morning.
It's very good to have you with us. Professor Miguel Tinker Salas, tell us what happened. When did the sheriff's deputies come to your home?
They came to my office last Tuesday as I was having office hours. I have my door always open, and I noticed two individuals walk by who obviously by their age and dress and stature were not students. And they joined and milled around outside my office. And I could hear them talking to students. And when the student that I was working with left, they entered and identified themselves as L.A. County sheriffs working on the with the Joint Terrorism Task Force. And they began very interestingly talking about my credentials and about my work and about my publications. And then the conversation quickly moved into discourse about the Venezuelan community in the Southern California area and in the United States. They were keenly interested in finding out about the nature of this community, its where it congregated, its ties to the Venezuelan consulate, its relationship to the Venezuelan embassy. Would it respond to any proclamations being put forth by the government? And I found these questions rather disingenuous because much of this is public information. Had they simply gone to the internet, they would have found out that there is no Venezuelan consulate in Los Angeles. They would have found out that the community in Venezuelans in Southern California is relatively small. And when I pushed them on these questions, they kept insisting that they were there to develop a profile of this community and concerns over security. And that troubled me.
Well, Professor, I'd like to ask you, the Chavez administration in Venezuela has been accused of many things by the Bush administration, but to my knowledge, involvement in terrorism is not one of them. Your sense of why they would be even asking, or did you say to them, what does this have to do with anti-terrorism work?
I was concerned because that very day in the front page of the LA Times, there was an article citing Condoleezza Rice trying to link Venezuela to some new axis of evil that included North Korea and Iran. And particularly with her statements about inoculating Venezuela and John Negroponte's statements to the same effect, it concerned me that there was now being a connection made between Venezuelan immigrants who are here to make a living as are hundreds of thousands of other immigrants, and somehow now the idea that the state could in some way move this population to become a security threat. And that I was concerned by that correlationship they were drawing.
But there was also, as I understand it, another Venezuelan-born professor at your college who was not questioned as well, right? So it would indicate that they're also concerned about the political views of the various people they're questioning.
Precisely. When they left the room, I asked them what was their intent, and they said, "Well, this is only the first of many visits we plan to take into account in the Southern California area. We plan to be talking to a lot of professors to deepen this idea of a profile." And when I questioned them further, the questions became personal. The questions became, are you a U.S. citizen? They also became, where did you go to school? What is your background? And that's interesting because on their lap, they had a profile which gave them that information. On their lap, I could see that they had downloaded a copy of the Pomona College webpage that has my faculty profile. So they were asking me questions to which they already had an answer. So again, it seemed very disingenuous.
What are you planning to do now, and how has Pomona responded? How has the college that you are a professor of Chicano and Latin American Studies responded?
The college response has been extremely supportive. I'm heartened by my colleagues who have all indicated support and opposition to this intrusion into the academic arena by state agents. The president has issued a very strong statement. The neighboring colleges in the Claremont Consortium have issued also very strong statements, as has the American Association of University Professors, the AAUP. What I'm concerned about is if they are interviewing other scholars with this intent, I would like to have, as a public discourse, what is their intent? How many people have they interviewed? What is the objective of trying to link an immigrant community with purported questions of security or terrorism? And what are the implications? What is their objective? I would like this policy to be part of an open discourse, particularly concerning now that we have the renewal of the Patriot Act and we have all the issues of Homeland Security, and we have the NSA wiretapping people in the U.S. I am concerned where this is going and what the implications are for not only academic freedom, but for also public discourse in the U.S.
Professor Tinker-Salas, we only have 10 seconds, but you're at the Latin American Studies Association conference in San Juan. Has LASA taken a stand?
It is on their agenda. It is before the executive body. It's also before the Venezuelan section. So we hope that there will be a statement coming out of this organization as well.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us from San Juan, Puerto Rico. As we turn now to a colleague in Bolivia, Professor Huascar Ari, a visiting professor in La Paz, Bolivia. He's an Aymara activist, founded the Quechua Aymara Foundation in La Paz and seven grassroots groups in Bolivia and Peru, first director of the largest internet site on the Aymara peoples. But our question to you first, Professor Ari, is why we're speaking to you in Bolivia as opposed to at the University of Nebraska.
Hello, everybody. Taking your question, please. I couldn't listen well.
What is the reason that you're not teaching at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, where you were invited?
Well, the reason is that my work permit is not ready yet, and it's about 9 months that I'm expecting my work permit. But also I learned that my previous visas were canceled, and that through the Chronicle of Higher Education, I learned that actually the State Department ordered to cancel it.
And has the State Department given you any explanation of why this has happened or what information led them to cancel your visas?
Well, I never got any information. Once I went to the vice consul here in La Paz and talked with the vice consul, and she just asked me to show my passport, and she canceled the visas. And before I could have asked why she was doing that, she just said, "We don't know. This is just the State Department ordered us to do this. You should know." And that was all.
We're talking to Professor Huascar Ari, who was invited to be a professor at the University of Nebraska, but at this point has been not allowed into the country. I wanted to get your reaction, Professor Ari, to the Secretary of State, Condoleezza Rice, at the inauguration of the new Chilean president, Michelle Bachelet, visiting with Evo Morales, the president of Bolivia. I believe he gave her a guitar that she played on that was made of coca leaf, which she didn't realize at the time. But your response to that meeting?
Well, the guitar is the charango. That's something very traditional in Bolivia, and the Bolivians, through President Morales, just wanted to show her that well, this is very Bolivian, and that was mostly related with something that earlier happened in Chile, in which President Lagos gave the charango to another personality, and that was in relation to that. About the coca leaves, I read that in the international news, but information about that there is not in Bolivia. I haven't heard about that.
I'd like to ask you also a few about the case of Leonidas Zurita, a leader among Bolivia's peasants and coca farmers, who's also had a visa revoked after the U.S. government received, quote, information, they said, about her, and that the order came from the ambassador of the U.S. To Bolivia that she not be allowed to travel to the U.S. Has that gotten much attention there in your country?
Yeah, that's right. That got some attention in the country. First of all, Bolivia is a country that more or less used to this problem about visa. So visa is not a big news in Bolivia. And this issue about Mrs. Zurita was in the news, and the reactions are that that case, by the way, is different than mine, because the embassy gave an explanation and said openly that this is about security concern, and they quoted some parts of the Patriotic Act, so this is something that had explanation. But in my case, it's different because I never got an explanation about why my case is a case. But in terms of Mrs. Zurita, there was some reactions in Bolivia about the way that was she treated, and I guess this is an issue that institutions in Vermont are still trying to get a visa for her.
And, of course, she's a close confidant of the new president, Evo Morales.
That's right.
Oscar Ari, what has been the response in the United States and the academic community to the U.S. government saying they have, quote, derogatory information on you, though they're not willing to share it with you or the University of Nebraska?
Well, I got a strong support from the University of Nebraska, Lincoln, and they wrote letters to the Department of Homeland Security, the State Department, and asking information. And then also at Georgetown, my PhD is from Georgetown, the president also wrote to the Condoleezza Rice, and then the American Association of University Professors also. So basically, but the most strongest support is from the American Historical Association. So basically now it's, people are writing letters asking that they should give me visa.
Professor Oscar Ari, want to thank you for being with us. Supposed to be at the University of Nebraska, but remains right now in Bolivia. We thank you for joining us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. Next up, after break, we go to Miami to a janitor strike against the University of Miami. Stay with us. Victor Jara, The Right to Live in Peace, here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
We turn now to Florida, where nearly 200 janitors working for the Unico company are on strike at the University of Miami. The non-unionized janitors, who are mostly Haitian and Cuban immigrants, earn as little as $6.40 an hour and are not provided with health insurance. Although the janitors officially work for Unico, they are also calling on the university to pressure the company to provide them with a livable wage and health benefits. In particular, striking workers have criticized University President Donna Shalala for refusing to get directly involved in the dispute. Shalala has been a longtime advocate for the poor. During the 1990s, she served as President Clinton's Secretary for Health and Human Services. In 2001, she said her biggest regret was not being able to secure affordable health coverage for all Americans.
But Shalala is now being criticized for living a life of luxury while the school's janitorial staff is living on about $50 a day. The New York Times Magazine recently photographed Shalala inside her 9,000-square-foot residence. The house is so big, she says her dog has four beds. In the same article, she discusses vacationing in the Kingdom of Bhutan, her new 29-foot motorboat, and how she's hired staff to make her bed each day. Shalala's lifestyle has not gone unnoticed. A recent column in the Miami Herald was titled, quote, "While Shalala lives in luxury, janitors struggle." Meanwhile, Unico has been highly critical of SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, for its union organizing efforts of the janitors. On a new website called universitytruth.com, the company charged that, quote, SEIU is most interested in bloating its ranks and reaching into the pockets of our workers for dues. Meanwhile, Unico has been accused of harassing workers who've backed unionization. The Orlando Sentinel reports the National Labor Relations Board has accused Unico of interrogating workers workers about their union support, forcing them to sign a statement disavowing the union and calling workers disloyal for attending union functions. In February, one Unico employee, Zoila Mersouli, was fired shortly after talking to the Orlando Sentinel about her efforts to organize a strike among her fellow University of Miami maintenance workers.
To discuss the strike, we now go to Miami, where we're joined by Clara Vargas, a janitor who is on strike at the University of Miami. She'll be translated by Gretchen Begley. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Clara Vargas. I'd like you to tell us a little bit about your conditions there and the strike, why you felt compelled to strike. Quiero darle la bienvenida a Clara Vargas y preguntarle un poco de las condiciones en su trabajo allá y por qué tomaron la decisión de ir a la huelga.
Bueno, primeramente tomamos la decisión de ir a la huelga porque nosotros queremos obtener respeto, justicia y dignidad.
First of all, we decided to strike because we wanted respect, justice, and dignity.
Con ningún supervisor, pero sé que muchos han maltratado, humillado y amenazado a sus trabajadores, inclusive para que no salgan a la huelga porque van a ser despedidos.
We have been humiliated, harassed, because we have wanted to strike.
El caso de mi mamá.
Clara, si puede esperar un párrafo, entonces dejar que la muchacha aquí pueda traducir lo que está diciendo.
Okay, está bien, está bien.
And people have been fired because we have been organizing to strike.
Siga entonces.
Mi mamá es un ejemplo vivo de esto. Ella se enferma de cáncer.
My mother is a perfect example of this. She is sick with cancer.
Yeah. En el proceso de la operación, después la quimioterapia y las radiaciones, ella estuvo unos meses sin trabajar.
After having an operation and chemotherapy, she was unable to work for 2 months.
Cuando ella regresa al trabajo, la pone en una posición que no es la de ella, que ella no puede hacer.
When she returned to work, they put her in a position that was not her job, and she was not able to do it.
Porque la posición que ella tenía anteriormente de enfermarse, ella no tiene que hacer ningún tipo de peso. Ella sencillamente es limpiar porque hay un hombre que trabaja con ella que es el que saca la basura.
She is not able to lift anything and she needs someone to work with her to lift up the trash.
La pone en una posición que ella no puede. Cuando ella le dice al supervisor que por qué la está poniendo en esa posición, él les dice que él sabe que la posición que ella puede hacer es la de ella, pero que es decisión de él no dársela.
She says that she is able to do her own job, but her supervisor has refused and has put her in a job that she's unable to do.
Y yo quisiera preguntarle la importancia de tener seguro médico para ustedes como trabajadores, considerando la situación médica de su mamá.
What's the importance of having health insurance, considering the situation of your mother?
Ella se enferma, no la ponen en su posición, ahora mismo está sin trabajo, no le dieron ninguna explicación de por qué no le daban la posición de ella, ni le dieron ninguna.
She has gotten sick and she is not given any explanation of why she's not able to go back to her job and she's without work.
Y ahora debe alrededor de más de $80,000 en el Jackson, que no sabe cómo lo va a pagar.
Y entonces, and she owes over $80,000 at the hospital and doesn't know how she's going to pay it.
Y yo creo que tanto UNICO como la universidad, que son instituciones tan ricas, nos pueden dar a nosotros un futuro mejor para
I think
nosotros
that
y nuestra familia.
The university and UNICO are rich organizations and they have the ability to give us a better future for our families.
Okay, muchas gracias a Clara por estar con nosotros. Thank you very much for being with us, Clara.
That was Clara Vargas, one of the janitors at the University of Miami on strike. For a discussion about the strike, we're joined by two other guests in Miami as well. Jill Hurst is Deputy Director of the Property Services Division of the Service Employees International Union. And we're joined by UNICO spokesperson Doug Bailey. Doug Bailey, let's begin with you. We want to thank you both for being with us. Can you talk about UNICO and why the workers don't get health care?
Well, you know, we employ 18,000 people across the country. We have 9,000 unionized employees. Some have health care benefits, some don't. I guess the simplest reason is we pay the prevailing wage. Actually, we pay something above the prevailing wage in Southern California. You would find this kind of wage and benefit package in many employers across Southern California, and yet Unico is being targeted, singled out as the problem here, unfairly singled out as the problem here. This is the prevailing wage, and this is the condition of the market in Southern California.
And but you're in Miami, though.
Correct?
You're in Miami, at the University of Miami. You're talking about Southern California?
Southern Florida, I'm sorry.
And
that is the wage rate here. You could check with other contractors.
And Mr. Bailey, what about the conclusions of the NLRB in terms of labor violations by your company?
Well, this company has worked here at University of Miami for 14 years without a single OSHA complaint, without a single NLRB complaint. And now suddenly, with the union coming here, watching us carefully, with the press here watching us carefully, with the administration watching us carefully, suddenly there's a flurry of all these complaints, and suddenly we've developed an anti-union stance. It's just hogwash. You know, there's two things to remember. There could not have been a legal strike without NLRB complaints. We think that was a means to an end. We're not anti-union. As I said, more than 9,000 of our employees are already unionized, most of them in the SEIU. So the idea that we've suddenly developed an anti-union stance is just hogwash.
Jill Hurst of the SEIU, the Service Employees International Union, your response?
Well, I think it's clear that the cleaners that work for Unico at the University of Miami have a right to live a decent life and to make good wages and have health benefits. And there may not be charges for the last 14 years, but the workers have decided that it's time to fight for a better life, and they're trying to do that. Unfortunately, when they began to do that, Unico and the University of Miami responded by intimidating people, threatening people, spying on people, trying to force people to sign statements that were blatantly illegal about not supporting the union. And so there are unfair labor practice charges that have been investigated by the NLRB, who's charged with that, and the federal government has said yes, they believe that, in fact, Unico did that. And so they're pursuing those charges. Unfortunately, it takes a very long time for the system to work. So though the charges began with violations of the law back in September, we are hoping to have a trial now scheduled in late May. So as this goes forward, it just means that every day things get worse for people who work for Unico at the University of Miami. And workers said they wanted the unfair labor practices to stop, that they wanted to be treated with respect and dignity. And, of course, they want a decent wage and health benefits. People like Clara's mother and many of their coworkers shouldn't have to have $80,000 in hospital debt after working full-time for many years at an institution that's as wealthy as the University of Miami. This is an institution with $1 billion in endowment. They have the ability to tell Unico what they need to pay and whether or not they should provide health benefits, and they have the ability to tell Unico to treat workers with respect and dignity as it relates to their laws under the NLRB. And that's Jill, what the workers are fighting for.
Jill Hurst, I'd like to ask you, we did ask the University of Miami and Donna Shalala's office if she or someone would come on to talk about the case, but they insist that this is a labor dispute between your union and Unico as a contractor to the university. It does not involve them. But I'd like to ask you, at Harvard University, for instance, I understand Unico also represents the employees at Harvard, and there the employees actually are paid considerably more and do have health insurance. Could you talk a little bit about that?
That's correct. They do. After the workers at Harvard had reached a really low point and were making very low wages with little or no benefits, working part-time, Harvard reached a point of saying that, you know, this is not their policy. That's not how they want their janitors to live. And so they have a policy they passed after a struggle that the students and workers led that says that the janitors at Harvard have to be paid a living wage. They have to be provided full, affordable family health benefits. And be provided all the benefits that many of us take for granted, some sick time, some vacation, things that the janitors at the that work for Unico as well at the University of Miami have none of. And so the Harvard janitors have had their lives transformed through that struggle, and Unico has been willing to do it because Harvard told them they had to. And any other cleaning contractor at Harvard also has to, and there are several. Unico is the largest. Apparently, the University of Miami has not chosen to take a similar action despite many requests. So they've now formed a committee after the workers were ready to vote to go on strike to end the unfair labor practices. The University of Miami is now has a small committee that's looking at wages and benefits. I fully expect they will finally try to do something about living wages and benefits as a result of the fight led by the janitors. But that still leaves them with fear, intimidation, threats, people being terminated, et cetera. But I do believe that the University of Miami and Donna Shalala are not going to be able to remain by the wayside at this point.
We've been reading some of the articles in the Miami Herald, which said Donna Shalala is in Haiti this past weekend to talk about health care for the Haitian people. She's also the former, of course, Secretary of Health and Human Services. And Doug Bailey, I was wondering if you agree with the University of Miami that this doesn't have anything to do with them, that this is purely between you and the janitors, the your company, Unico.
You know, Donna Shalala has study the market conditions, to study the wage and compensation benefits for all workers, all contract workers, not just Unico workers, for all of it. And she is going to come out with a report, and she is going to come out with a recommendation that's going to affect all workers, not just Unico workers. And that's a good thing. Now you're hearing what the union is saying already. They're already changing their stance. They realize that this wage and package is coming, and these benefits are coming. They could declare victory and go home. We'd be very happy with that, but they're not. Now they're changing the dialogue to these NLRB complaints, these trumped-up charges, because that's going to be the focal point of their campaign going forward. They're not going to be happy with these wage package and benefit increases because they won't be able to get into the pockets of these workers and get a percentage of it, and that's what's going to happen from now on.
But, Mr. Bailey, if you are paying much higher wages and health benefits at Harvard to your employees there,
you could go to a McDonald's in Boston and find a higher wage rate than here in Southern Florida. I mean, market conditions vary from place to place. You know, as I said, we have 9,000 unionized employees. We have 18,000 employees across the country. You can go to Phoenix. You can go to Seattle. There are different wage rates for different markets. If the union is successful in the current campaign, all it will do is make Unico uncompetitive in this market because we'll be forced to pay a higher rate than our own competitors will have to pay. It'll drive us out of business. They have thousands of unionized workers that will be affected if this company goes out of business. Is that what they want? Is that the end game here?
Jill Hurst, what about that? What about that if you are successful, you're going to only end up driving Unico out and unable to be able to continue to service the university?
I cannot imagine how a company with 20,000 employees can be driven out of business by 400 janitors making a living wage and health benefits and choosing to have a union. The truth is that these janitors have been saying that they want an end to the unfair labor practices, they want a living wage, they want health benefits. If the university finally decides to do that, that's because of the struggle led by these janitors. And we'll be thrilled. That will be a tremendous victory for these workers. And we think it'll give hope to millions of workers in southern Florida, where people really see this as a fight to change this community.
Well,
it's a tremendously poor city.
We'll have to leave it there. Jill Hurst, Deputy Director of Property Services Division of the Service Employees International Union, and Doug Bailey of Unico, spokesperson there. And special thanks to translator Gretchen Begley. That does it for today's broadcast. If you'd like to get a copy, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. We look forward to seeing folks in the New York area at our big 10th anniversary celebration at Cooper Union Hall in New York City on Saturday night, an evening's conversation with Harry Belafonte. You can go to our website for tickets at democracynow.org and for more information at 7 o'clock Saturday night at Astor Place in Manhattan. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Odokadus, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yuri Richin, Maddie Harper, Aaron Matei. Also special thanks to Megan Whitney and Danielle Peshkin. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez, our website, democracynow.org.